Welcome to the SFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
It's the 27th of July. Hello and welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm Duduzile Ramela in for Jimmy Moyaha this evening. Here's what you can look forward to in a few moments. We speak to our market watcher, Kiarabilwe Nonyana, VIP client manager at Prime XBT, about market movements. We're going to be touching on the decline in the Bab al-Mandeb Strait traffic, which is driving energy prices as well. Professor Patrick Bond, distinguished professor of sociology at the University of Johannesburg, will weigh in on that. We also talk about protecting the local industry in an increasingly protectionist world with Ayabonga Tsawen. This, of course, in light of the 12.5% tariffs that were slapped on South Africa on Friday. National Treasury has submitted their compliance report to the Financial Action Task Force. You'll remember last year we got out of the grey list in October, and so a new round begins. Bradley Elliott will tell us what this all means. For now, though, our market watcher.
The day's markets, understanding the moves and making smarter investment calls.
Kiarabilwe Nonyana, always a pleasure to be in conversation with you, VIP client manager at Prime XBT, a green screen save for resources. Kia, how should we interpret today's moves? Good evening.
I think, good evening to your listeners and good evening to yourself. I think much of the same, but what I really characterize our market is a hunt for value, because when you start looking at really the moving parts of the market breadth, you're seeing a lot of movement in the industrial 25, which really tells you there's a bit of value hunting, particularly in Naspers and as well as Process. But if you look at the top leaders as well, Mondi also performing well, and I think it's just the market reevaluating value and really going for the 10 baggers.
We take a look at Mr. Price and Vodacom, but I think on Mr. Price, that share price up 2.8%. Looking at the Fashini share price, how should we understand the two, right? More so the Fashini group. What's happening there?
I mean, when we look at the price of Fashini and all, when you look at the chart, it's back to its 10-year lows. And that's just on the back of the fact that management has found a way to always butcher capital. And what I really am concerned about is Mr. Price, for me, is following down the same road, investing elsewhere when you don't have a clear competitive advantage at home. And I think the market is just truly just battering those shares. And I personally, I think it's warranted.
Vodacom share price also up on the back of their trading update for the first quarter. Egypt, that market doing really well for Vodacom. What stood out for you?
I think this is the first result where Vodacom is integrating Safaricom into its earnings, since they've taken a controlling stake. I think previously they were holding just close to about 34%. Now they hold about 55%. And right now they're bidding down that transaction. And I think Safaricom is really at the precipice of really financial fintech evaluation, because I think they are going to be one of the biggest storers of value and as well movers of value in the African continent. And I think for these big utilities such as Vodacom, they're trying to find value outside of the utility of mobile data as well as voice telecommunications. And I think right now Vodacom is quite rightly doing it well.
Sasol share price today down 3%. This in spite of crude oil going down some, 12%, I see here, the price of crude oil, $86 a barrel. How should we understand that?
Yeah, it's quite rightly the move from the $100 level in Brent crude per barrel, which we saw later on in the week as tensions in the Strait of Hormuz rocketed up. And I always tell my team is that, you know, you could write a report on Thursday and on Friday morning, it will be completely untrue. And for me, I mean, I did write a report to our clients as to why I think Brent crude could sustainably see prices above $100. And I'm I'm quite wrong. And it is much of the same because of the fact that we go into the weekends with tensions quite rightly up, geopolitical tensions between the US and Iran. And it's completely on three fronts. I mean, it's the Strait of Hormuz, as well as the Houthis are also attacking the Black Sea as well. So, I mean, right now, it's much of the same, but nothing new, because as I always say, the truth is the first thing to die in any war.
And you look at more so, just for like, I'd like for us to go down the rabbit hole when we speak about the tensions between the United States and Iran, right? And you look at least the capital markets in the United States, their best ever. You'd almost swear that they're just ignoring what is happening. How should we understand that in spite of this high volatility, that output is at its highest?
I think the market can quite rightly looks over geopolitical crises, because I think since the 2020, I think it's been 6 years of straight geopolitical crisis, starting from the coronavirus and then the Ukraine-Russia war, and then later on then the US-Iran war. And I think the market just overrightly just looks at it. And how do they look over that? It's just purely just looking at fundamentals and earnings. I mean, some of these companies around the world, even including our JSE, are just producing record earnings, albeit quite historical. But if you had to look at just the past 90 days, you're looking at the likes of Alphabet, Tesla, coming out, Intel coming out with record earnings, almost some of them recording 12 straight quarters of earnings beats, and just investing much more into this AI trade. And I think the market is just looking at this and like, what should we evaluate? The fact that Alphabet has risen its guidance on CapEx to almost 200 billion, or look at the Strait of Hormuz closing. But I think that that's what the market is really evaluating at the moment.
Sustainability, because have they demonstrated utility?
I quite rightly think so, because I think this is purely a supply and demand issue. Because when you look at just right through this AI trade, from the microchips and the fabrication plants, right through to the hyperscaler and software developers at the front, what you're seeing is just demand right across. And I think even when you look at the final product, which is the hyperscaler data centers, there's so much demand which is coming, right? I mean, I can tell you, Alphabet has 951 million users right now. So almost an eighth of the world really uses Gemini as a front end. And I mean, you can look right through Anthropic and OpenAI. This is just but the beginning of what I call the fourth industrial revolution.
Taking a look at resources, Thungela, Glencore, Anglo, Harmony, all down. How should we understand these moves?
I think it's on the back of that. When you look at particularly Thungela, I mean, I think when you look maybe a month ago before the unrest that reignited, you see Thungela has been part of one of the drivers of the performance of the JSE, because of it's just a coal play and people are looking for alternative sources of energy when you're looking at 20% of the world's LNG and as well Brent crude moving through the Strait of Hormuz. But I think on Anglo American particularly as well, I mean, they've quite rightly simplified the operations. They're coming into just high grade iron ore, high grade copper, and really trying to find ways to simplify that. But when you look at regression as well, the price of iron ore held up, the price of copper has done very well, but over the past few days it's come quite rightly come down. But as well as our rand has really performed well over the past 24 hours.
It's trading at 16 rand 74 to the dollar. Is it also just reading the mood of what's happening in the Middle East?
Yeah, I think it quite rightly touched almost $17 to 17 rands to the dollar almost at the end of the week. And I think that geopolitical risk premium just unwound on Monday morning with the news coming out of the US and Iran that they are seeking to regress the brinkmanship which is happening there. But I think right now the rand quite rightly, I find it quite duplicitous. And why I say that is because when you look at the risk factors, which should be affecting the rand. I think it's quite rightly held its own, and that's just on the back of the fact that we have great carry trade, as well as the SARB front loading the interest rate hikes, kind of just moved ahead of the Fed, which are going to be announcing their July rates on Wednesday.
Where do you see Kevin Walsh going? He's been very, what, not forthcoming with information or trying to give guidance, right? Where do you see that going? Number one. Number two, just coming back home. I don't think we spoke to you about the Reserve Bank holding interest rates last week. What did you make of that?
I think I was quite rightly surprised. I think the market was really anticipating that the interest rates were going to be hiked up by the SARB when you looked at our inflation print breaching the 5% level. And I've been quite a critic of the Reserve Bank, and I think their understanding of normative economics, as well as modern day monetary economics, has been quite rightly limited. And I think they view our economy as a closed economy, even though we're suffering through these supply side shocks. I think it was quite progressive for them to hold rates, but I think the discussions at the previous meeting about a 50 basis point hike was quite rightly concerning. I think that's what the market was pricing in, that they did believe that there was going to be a rate hike in the previous meeting. Going on to Kevin Walsh, I think he's quite a progressive Fed chair, because he kind of just revolutionized the Fed statement first, and the way he's willing to go and attack inflation, even though the president that appointed him really wanted interest rate cuts. So I think he's really taken this role as his own man, and I think it's really been seen in the fact that he's changed the Fed statement, and it's been rather hush about what his interest rate outlook is. But when you look at the dot plot, I think we may see a 25 basis point hike later on in the year.
What he's been described by some sectors as a hawk in a dove's skin. That's where we'll have to leave it for now. Gerabi Lunanyana is a VIP client manager at Prime XBT. Thank you.
You are listening to the market update on SAFM.
So according to reports, Houthi rebels say they have not closed the Bab al-Mandeb Strait. This after initial reports suggested they had. The strait is located between Yemen to its northeast and Djibouti and Eritrea in the Horn of Africa to the southwest. Distinguished professor at the University of Johannesburg, Professor Patrick Bond, joins us to speak on the importance of this particular strait, Prof. Thank you very much for your time. Perhaps that's the point of departure. Why is this particular strait important?
Well, it has been important really since early 2024. That's when the Houthis were initially able to actually board ships, including tankers. But there's a huge amount of traffic. 12% of the world's traffic goes through there. And in early 2024, it was because of the emerging genocide by Israel of Palestine, in which the Houthis said, we can do something to put pressure, a sort of boycott, divestment, sanctions pressure to prevent the port of Eilat, the southern port of Israel, from getting goods, because that then ended up shutting it down. The Suez Canal is the other major part, the northern part of that Red Sea, and the logic of having a huge Israeli port there suddenly ends, because its only function was to take goods that were coming through the south side. And so that's really had an extraordinary impact on the Israeli economy. But it showed that a small group, the Houthis, with both their own helicopters, with speedboats, with short-range missiles, with drones, could actually close down 12% of the world trade. And we, of course, got a great deal of it coming then through the south side of Africa, the Indian Ocean, and up the Atlantic, taking a few more weeks of sailing and a lot more cost to world shipping.
Fast forward to 2026, the conflict between Iran and the United States has seen disruption to oil supplies, as we all know. Saudi Arabia, though, has turned its Red Sea port of Yanbu to ship crude out through the Bab al-Mandeb Strait. In the event it does close, what does this tell us about the already fragile relations between Gulf nations? Irreparable damage here being done?
Yes, but also irreparable to the United States. And I think that's a major factor in Donald Trump putting a pause on bombing. Many would say it's also because he's run out of weapons and he's worried about drawing down stocks that he needs elsewhere in the world, where U.S. imperialism is very ambitious. But I think the main thing is, if you're looking at oil suddenly going about $100, and then futures at 114 at the end of last week. Then comes this extraordinary moment where the Houthis enter the fray and Donald Trump does a U-turn. So even though it seems very scary that this small group that is a sort of a partially legitimate government in the west side of Yemen, where there's a sort of UN-recognized government on the east side, but they are actually able, as are others, Iranians in the Strait of Hormuz and maybe the Strait of Malacca, that's the other very crucial waterway. And it just shows that if you put too much emphasis on world shipping as a way to get your goods in and out, if you're very exposed to international trade, you may be in trouble if these geopolitical hotspots blow up.
Absolutely. What opportunity does this present for the African continent, if at all? And I ask this very particularly because let me just step back. And when COVID came around, we said, oh, what opportunity does this present for the African continent when there was fighting between, or still is fighting between Russia and Ukraine? What opportunity does this present for the African continent, more so when ships have to reroute? Maybe the question again, here we are in 2026, what opportunity does this present, and are we ready to catch that opportunity or realize that opportunity?
I doubt it, because our ports are so congested with container traffic, especially the major port of Durban, but also Cape Town, which ends up in the world's worst, least efficient ports, not because of any natural fault there. It's very difficult weather, and the congestion in that city helps explain why you couldn't really expect Cape Town to suddenly become a beneficiary of this, the shipping that goes around. I think instead we would say maybe that the show of force by the Houthis and the Iranians' capabilities of withstanding constant bombing then put Africa at great risk, with higher petrol prices, again up to $100 per barrel, and then shortages of fertilizers coming from the Gulf, and also then the knock-on effect on food, disaster, and major threats of inflation, and then higher interest rates, and then more debt defaults. And these are all of the knock-on effects that we would expect if the war continues. But what we're really seeing is a show of strength from the underdogs here, the Iranians and Houthis. And of course, the Houthis themselves say, well, we're also attacking Saudi Arabia because they attacked us. And that means, I think we might see a realization from the US and Israel that they can't actually defeat, and that the costs to the world economy are too high. And that when Trump goes into his election in November with a world recession, with high inflation, with the Fed probably putting up interest rates at some point between now and the election, well, I think actually these Houthis have made a decisive intervention, and the Iranians' capabilities, hidden away as they are in those mountains above that thin little Strait of Hormuz, it's formidable.
There must be an indicator that tracks volatility. I have not seen it, but I can only assume that it's at its highest level, especially given what has been happening in the past 2 years, or over the past 2 years. Donald Trump has made it known that he will run until 2028. And so, can we expect more of the same, this volatility, this disruption? And how do we adjust? Because some would argue that this is, we're feeling the birthing pains of a new world order. All of this is to cement the US's hegemony in the world.
Yes, they certainly want to control oil, and taking Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, just kidnapping him, with about 120 fatalities of the people around Maduro on January 3rd, was just one indication. And Donald Trump said, we are pirates. He actually said that this is now the modus operandi. I think the Cubans would have probably been invaded quite a bit earlier had Trump and Netanyahu succeeded in Iran. They're holding on, but they're under terrible conditions of a blockade by especially Marco Rubio, the U.S. Secretary of State, whose family is right-wing Cuban. And then we look at maybe other sites where there is potential oil, and especially the rare earth minerals. And if I were Danish, and especially if I were in Greenland, I'd be very worried that Donald Trump isn't joking around when he repeatedly brings up the need and his desire, especially as a lame duck president in the last 2 years of his regime, and with probably a hostile Congress, depending on what happens on November 3rd this year. But I think what we can expect is this, the brutality, the bullying, and also Donald Trump as the world's greatest ever con man, because you can never expect him to actually follow through with what he says. You can't trust him in a negotiation. And you know that the U.S. is using its last remaining part of military power because it can't get consensus and a general hegemony based upon respect. That's gone.
Thank you very much, Prof, as always, for your contribution. Professor Patrick Bond is Distinguished Professor at the University of Johannesburg.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
There's a song that goes, money can't buy me love. And that's true. But then they told us, all you need is love. Which anybody with a mortgage will tell you, most certainly is not true. Love won't pay your parking tickets. Or your student loan. It's also needy. It requires effort, availability, constant care. But more importantly, love requires time. And while money can't buy you love, it can certainly free up some of your time. Time to spend on the things you love, with the people you love. And if you're looking, maybe even time to find the one you love. That's why, after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do the things you love. And don't you love that about investing? Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.
It's 27 minutes after 6 o'clock. Thank you very much for staying with us. So no sooner had the temporary worldwide tax of 10% expired on Friday, the 24th of July, a new 10 to 12.5% tariff was announced by the Trump administration. Now, this applies to goods from 60 trading partners. South Africa and 40 other economies are accused of failing to curb imports made by forced labor passing through their supply chains and thus slapped with 12.5% tariffs. This has by and large been interpreted as an inflationary move. Vuyabonga Cawe is Chief Commissioner of the International Trade Administration Commission of South Africa, also known as ITAC, the country's regulatory body responsible for administering international trade, including tariffs, trade remedies and import-export controls. Dada, a very good evening to you and thank you very much for your time. Maybe we can start with a fact-checking exercise. Does South Africa impose or enforce forced labor practices of exported goods?
Good evening to you, Tutu, and good evening to your listeners, and thank you so much for having us. And I think your fact check is probably giving me a bit of deja vu from the hearings of the USTR a few weeks ago on the 9th of July, where a similar question was posed to us as part of the South African delegation to the Section 301 committee that was looking at this issue. I think it's important for us to say two things. The first is that South Africa, in its constitution, outlaws forms of forced slave and child labor. So all these coercive forms of labor are outlawed by our constitution. Section 113 of the Customs and Excise Act outlaws convict labor. And the point we're making, I think, to the American authorities was that if you look at those two pieces of legislation and you look at also Section 6 of the International Trade Administration Act of 2002, you do have instruments there that could make for a import prohibition. And that South Africa is in a process of multi-agency and interdepartmental reform to give effect not just to the issue regarding coercive forms of labor, but other forms of supply chain intelligence that would allow us to control and better understand the supply chain that gives rise to imports landing on our shores and how it is where some of that behavior is abhorrent in those supply chains. Mm-hmm. We are able to control it. But in the manner that I guess the United States trade representative would have wanted the prohibition, and I think we can discuss kind of why there's a sense here of some institutional uniformity that is sought, in the manner that they would have in their statute, which they've had right up until the 1930s, but have only really made use of it in the last few decades. South Africa would not have that kind of mechanism. Mm-hmm. But for the kind of behavior that we're targeting here, I think the point we were making at those USTR hearings was that South Africa does have the legislative framework, and I think reforms are underway to give effect to that, and also to multilateral a ratification that we have of the ILO Convention on Forced Labor.
So this institutional uniformity you speak of, what is it?
Well, I mean, the sense that we got as we went to the hearing was that, and even in the reports that preceded the hearing, so you would know that this matter came to light earlier in the year. The United States trade representative would have picked out about 60 or so countries constituting over 99% of their trade and would have said to these countries, you folk do not have a import prohibition akin to the one you find in the United States mm-hmm. that has the following: a designated enforcement authority, a public entity list or a list of entities of concern, a mechanism of rebuttable presumption, remediation requirements, and a clear evidentiary standard that would then allow for the border authorities in the US, I think it's Customs and Border Protection as they're called, which is quite similar to our South African Revenue Service. And then, of course, they would also have the Department of Labor and a few other agencies who would enforce such a system. So in a sense, everyone was brought through the same hoop, whether you are the Republic of South Africa, Angola, okay. Australia, or whomever. And those, from our reading, it seems, are the elements from an institutional uniformity vantage point that they would have wanted.
Got you. What changes? What is exempt and what is tariffed?
So our reading is certainly that there's some slight ambiguity, and you would know to do that. You've had, since the IEPA tariffs, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, another series of tariffs, ostensibly on balance of payment grounds, Section 122 tariffs, which are, we understand, are set to lapse in the next few days. And so one would imagine that these tariffs would come in their stead. And many of the exemptions we would have sought, we certainly haven't received all of those. But from what we are looking at, we're still studying what they've put together. Okay. Because, you know, what one might read doesn't always come across as self-evident when it comes to these things. And I think there's a bit of strategic ambiguity regarding what would fall under these tariffs and what would not. And the reason for that is the following: is that you do have certain products where we have agitated for exemptions that are already covered by a series of other tariffs. Take, for instance, Section 232 tariffs that we have on aluminium rolled products that go into the US, on steel, and also some of those tariffs have also been extended to vehicles. So I think, you know, it's cold comfort to say people have been exempted from these tariffs when they are also confronted by some of the national security tariffs as well.
100%. Just to expand on the latter, how have we weathered the tariff storm that swept through the country last year so far?
Well, I think there's two main elements of what has constituted a response on the part of South Africa. I think the first has been to try and understand the sectoral incidence of the shock. This is an export demand shock that makes it difficult for South African produced goods to make it into the United States, a market where we have enjoyed preferences under the General Systems of Preferences, the GSP, and of course the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA. I think that work occupied much of our time around April 2025 when the first set of tariffs came into play. And the second phase of that, and you would have heard Minister Tau speak to this at length, has been around assisting firms to diversify their export market.
Right.
How do you kind of, you know, weather the shock in a way that allows you and begins to reward those who seek out alternative markets, and as they do so, begin to really deal with whatever concentration risk we would have had. But I also think the other element to do, if you take the automotive sector, for instance, is that we would have heard when the tariffs came into play that there was also offset mechanisms for American importers, which softened the blow somewhat. We issued a survey sometime last year, and we have another one coming up with NAACAM, the component producer body. Many of their members export into the US. And what became clear to us was the impact was not as extensive as we would have anticipated. And that's because the Trump government, for 18-month to 24-month period, gave some of their importers some offsets. But in some value chains, because South African product has a particular quality profile, many of the importers have actually smothered the shock, paid the duties, and of course, in some instances, passed that on to consumers in the United States of America. So you haven't had this wide-scale contract and supply renegotiation that all of us would have expected. But that's not to say that it still is not yet to come.
Fair enough. Just very quickly for us, two questions before we let you go. Just going back onto the ambiguity on the detail. So when it comes to timelines and when this comes into effect, the 12.5%, is it a correct assumption to say we don't have that as yet? And the second question before we let you go, ITAC has recommended higher customs duties on imported peanut butter. What economic case supports this decision? And how do you safeguard the protective tariffs balance and the need to support local manufacturers without placing unnecessary cost pressures on consumers and food producers?
Quick one. I know you don't have too much time. On the first one, the 12.5% tariffs came into play last week. So on the 24th of July, anyone who has shipments or consignments destined for the United States will have some of their customers on the other side paying the duty. Then on the peanut butter matter, the commission recommended a few months ago to the Ministers of Finance and Trade an increase in the duty from around 99 cents a kilogram to around 20% of the value of peanut butter consignments. And this was on the back of an application by RCL, which is one of the producers of peanut butter in South Africa. And I think the economic case rests on two fronts. The one is that you had a tariff disparity in the supply chain for peanut butter. We have duties on groundnuts, which are input material into making peanut butter. But we actually had less than a 1% duty on peanut butter. So effectively, when you go to the shelves, for many exporters from other countries, it would have made more sense for them to export finished and complete peanut butter into South Africa because we're relatively unprotected compared to the protection we would have afforded to some of the groundnuts as a key input product. So there's that rationalization of the tariff structure. But then the second argument is, really, we've seen significant investment and deep price disadvantages if we compare with producers of peanut butter who have much greater scale in economy in parts of the world with our own producers who've made considerable investment in the last while. And so the economic case had to also balance that for you and me, this might mean much more expensive pricing for spreads or whatever people put into their smoothies. And I think we're a bit worried. And that's why we had to model the incidents and the consumer welfare implications of this. What we began to find was that there were those challenges from a price-raising effect, but on an objective balance of the evidence, it was the right thing to do. The applicant had asked for more, and we only came in at around 20% of ad valorem. But really, our task now is to monitor this and ensure that we also monitor peanut butter prices, which for us, concerningly, have been on an upward trajectory since the end of the COVID lockdowns. And so that's something we will continue to do, making good use of the NAMC price track and other metrics that we look at.
Yeah, and how on those peanut butter prices, they're real. Nkosi Dada Ayabonga Cawe is Chief Commissioner of the International Trade Administration Commission of South Africa, or ITAC, the country's regulatory body responsible for administering international trade, including tariffs, trade remedies, import and export controls.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
So today marked D-Day for Treasury to submit its initial technical compliance report for the Financial Action Task Force's new mutual evaluation. You'll remember we exited as a country the global watchdog for money laundering and terrorist financing's grey list after much reform. Now a new assessment cycle starts. We look at the road ahead where this is concerned with CEO of ReliComp, Bradley Elliott. Bradley, thank you very much for your time at this evening. What do we need to know about this latest assessment?
Yeah, absolute pleasure, Judith. Thanks for having me. Well, South Africa obviously exited the grey list around a year ago, and the latest assessment is just becoming more and more stringent. So international watchdogs have been tightening expectations on how countries police suspicious money flows, investigate corruption, and enforce penalties when it comes to controls fail. So yeah, they really are increasing scrutiny at the moment. And I think what's important to remember is that South Africa was originally put on the grey list not just for lax processes, but actually prosecution of these cases, which still seems to be a huge gap at the moment.
What then does that say, especially when we look at the road ahead? You speak of very stringent criteria. Does that suggest that we might fall short?
I don't think we're going to fall short. I think sitting on the other side of the table where a lot of our customers are regulated, the regulators are carrying out inspections. They really are enforcing the regulation as far as reasonably possible. And I think we won't be put back on the list. The banks are sitting in the middle of the fight at the moment. So, you know, they have to report up to the regulators. And it really is about prosecution. We are seeing some movement on the prosecution front. I think the impact looking forward is if we do get put back on the list, it is obviously a reputational damage to the country. But more importantly, it slows down inflows of investment into the country, and the consumer at the end of the day faces the damages, because ultimately the cost of compliance falls on them from these financial services institutions. The road ahead is not going to be easy. We've still got a lot of work to do, but I do believe that the regulators and the financial institutions in South Africa are doing a good enough job at the moment.
You mentioned that the consumer bears the cost of non-compliance. Can you just expand on that for us?
Sure. So when you have to increase your compliance obligations to the regulators, that comes with both a technology and human cost to the financial services institutions. And typically that then falls into their cost of sale, and they need to protect their margins. So ultimately what lands up happening is that that falls down to the consumer to bear the cost. In most instances, you'll see a rise in fees, or at least some sort of compliance fee being passed on to the consumer indirectly, either be through an increased bank fee as an example, or other sort of payment fees that come about. And then from a macroeconomic perspective, as I mentioned earlier, inflows of investment slow down because of increased scrutiny. That puts impact on the economy, which could also lead to kind of short-term inflation that wouldn't necessarily be there.
Okay. You mentioned that we are making progress when it comes to prosecutions. Does the quality of investigations into complex financial crimes, does it matter?
It matters hugely. And this really does start with the information that is fed to these investigators to carry out their investigations. And that information comes from the financial institutions that are reporting suspicious activities around anti-money laundering and corruption. Well, more anti-money laundering than corruption. But the quality of the data, the quality of the information that gets fed to investigators is extremely important. We do have the skills. There is a skill shortage from an investigative point of view. But that's why the regulators put so much pressure on the financial services institutions, is because the quality of the data ultimately can lead to either successful or unsuccessful prosecution.
There are deficiencies in the country's anti-money laundering and terrorist financing framework. If we take a look, for instance, the general laws or anti-money laundering and combating terrorism financing amendment bill, once that is adopted by Parliament after certain processes, do you see it going some way to maybe tick a particular box where the Financial Action Task Force is concerned?
Yes, I think obviously that's going to make our anti-money laundering or anti-money laundering regulation far more robust. That will tick a few of the boxes. I mean, we've already ticked, I think there were 27 items on the checklist for the FATF that we have already accounted for. And I think it's basically around the implementation of that. So we've moved from a checkbox kind of exercise in terms of regulation into a risk-based approach. And the new amendment really enforces the execution of that risk-based approach on financial services institutions.
I do wonder, South Africa is not the exception to the rule here, is it?
Definitely not.
Okay.
We are not the exception to the rule. You might note that a few other African countries recently got put back onto the grey list. Namibia, I think Kenya was one of them as well. So we're definitely not the exception to the rule, not only within Africa, but globally. And I think we are doing it really. I want to emphasize that I do think that at least from a regulatory perspective, and the regulators and financial institutions that we work with are really doing all they can to combat anti-money laundering and financial crime.
Maybe we can reiterate your advice to the financial institutions that you do indeed deal with.
Yeah, I mean, I think the advice is this doesn't only sit with technology. I mean, we're obviously sitting from a technology provider perspective. It sits with process. It sits with the governance processes that they've got in place and the governance forums and just the ability to move really quickly. I mean, we don't want to go into the whole AI conversation, but, you know, that is a huge threat. And I think a lot of the failures within financial institutions fall on personnel who might have been, let me say, captured, as opposed to the systems and integrity of the overarching system, which is actually, you know, what was brought up earlier is that there is a particular bank where one of the managers is sitting in court over an 87 million rand corruption and money laundering activity case. So a lot of the failures tend to be people related, not technology or process related. And my advice is, you know, how do you govern for that and make sure that that doesn't happen?
Interesting. Thank you very much for your time this evening. Bradley Elliott is CEO of ReliComp.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
In case you're on the highway, driving to your first big maize delivery and something mysterious happens, you stop at the garage to scope the damage, you realize the fuel system is kinda dear my car. You panic, but then you take a deep breath because you know Hino Care Gap Cover is there to cover anything outside the standard 6-year warranty. From steering columns to ABS control modules, it's the unseen essential in your business. Speak to your Hino dealer. T's and C's apply. Hino. All the way.
Hello again. Let's take a look at this now. The Rees Global Benchmarking Report on Mining has found that resource nationalism is on the rise. Ironically, as the minerals race gains steam, with so-called critical minerals being most sought after. For the green energy transition, the report has found that the window of opportunity is wide open for South Africa to position itself as a preferred critical minerals supplier. Kuda Mukova is CEO of Rees Africa, a strategy, innovation and sustainability firm. He joins us to go through some of the key findings. Thank you very much, Kuda, for your time this evening. So what is modernization in the context of this report and why does it matter?
Thank you, Duduzile, and thanks for having me, and good evening to your listeners. I think certainly for us, we see that there is four mega trends that are shaping mining at the moment. The global instability, I think, that we see at the moment, resource nationalism, I think, as you pointed out, but also the importance now of the critical minerals race and the sustainability pressure that we see in mining. So certainly, I mean, South Africa is positioned as a preferred critical mineral supplier. I think there's a window for us to modernize, but also take advantage of the low carbon economy as well as the ESG compliance requirements. So we definitely think the window is wide open at the moment in terms of South African mining.
Okay. The window's wide open. The breeze is blowing in. What do we see in terms of strengths?
So I think in terms of the current strengths that we see within South Africa, I think we've got quite a big mineral endowment in terms of PGMs, manganese, as well as chrome reserves. I think we also have a robust capital market via the JSE with more than 40 listed mining companies. We are well adopted in terms of ESG reporting. I think in excess of 90% of firms listed on the JSE comply with sustainability reporting. Our private market sector is very mature. I think we've seen in excess of 1.3 trillion private sector investment. And also from a safety perspective, I think if we look over the last 10 years, South Africa has really done well in terms of reducing fatalities over the last decade. So I think there's definitely a number of strengths there.
As the wind blows, it identifies some critical gaps. I'd like to take a look at the report that speaks to the country scorecards, right? So you've got in South Africa, enabling environment low, human capital medium, markets and value chains high, tick, advanced technology low, sustainability medium, health and safety medium, overall medium, especially given that you've got some more than 5,000 unresolved mining rights in this country. And so how do we reconcile this?
Yeah, so certainly I think, you know, what we did in terms of the research, we categorized the comparison, I think, to three broad groups. Firstly, it was what we call the visionaries, and these were the ones leading in terms of innovation, the likes of Australia and Sweden. And then we had the competitors, so those that we rival with, call it with a similar kind of mineral production level. And that was Canada, China, and Chile. And then the last group that we had was the contemporaries, so those that will have kind of similar structural contexts. And in there, we included the likes of the US, India, Brazil, and Saudi Arabia. So certainly what you see is, I think South Africa used to be a leader, I think, in a number of components. But due to a number of structural issues, be it regulatory in terms of our landscape or technology adoption, the divide, I think, in terms of what we're seeing in terms of graduates versus the skills that are required, our levels of beneficiation as well, and some of the aspects around infrastructure, right? We've seen that we've got aging infrastructure, be it road or rail. In addition to that, I think we've had many years of load shedding. So I think all those issues have obviously then caused us to then have a drag in terms of the contribution that mining has. And over the years, unfortunately, a number of economies have gone ahead of us in terms of that.
So the report has also found that governments are imposing export restrictions, tax hikes, and local content rules. That's across the board, all over the world. But there is a risk score which has recorded that it's climbing in a number of mining jurisdictions, especially on the African continent. What has been identified as the risks?
Yeah, so I think there has been, I think, a number of areas that we identified across the continent. Certainly, the resource nationalism in terms of, you know, in terms of what we're seeing, the restrictions that the governments have imposed across exporting, I think, as you rightfully said, we've seen a number of tax hikes, particularly in the mining sector itself, and also I think just some of the instability. In terms of some of the civil wars or civil actions that we've seen, have definitely pushed up the risk scores across a number of mining countries across the continent.
That's so interesting, because even in these areas where there's instability, there's still mining. There may be no road that, you know, the local community can use, but there's a road from the mine to the airport. So it's quite interesting. Thank you very much. That's all the time we can afford for now, at least. Kuda Mukova is CEO of Reese Africa, a strategy, innovation and sustainability firm.
You are listening to the Market Update on SAFM.
It's Monday, the 27th of July. Hello again, and thank you for staying with us. It's time now for our digital drive feature. Nafisa Akabor is standing by with the latest tech need to know. Hello, Nafisa. So tonight we review the Samsung Z Fold 8, Fold 8 Ultra Flip 8. Where do we start?
Hi, Dudu. Good to be back. Yeah, so fresh news from Samsung is that they just unveiled their new folding range. As we know that in the second half of the year, they revealed the Z series. But this year, it was quite interesting. I was a guest of Samsung at London last week for Unpacked. And what they did was they unveiled a new passport-sized foldable, the Z Fold 8. Very interesting, alongside the Fold 8 Ultra, which is like the flagship version. It now sort of comes in line with the S series that we're all familiar with, where there's one standard unit and there's one Ultra flagship. And then, as normal, they do a Flip 8, which is a little clamshell flip phone. But one of the most interesting things, I think, that's the talk of the town is the Z Fold 8, the passport style. So we typically, Samsung has been in the foldable game for quite some time. We're now in the 8th generation. It's a very mature product. So it's quite interesting that now they've taken a different approach with the size, because it's more easily, you can read books now, you can do so many things on the device. It's easier to hold. It's not just thin and long like the previous one. And the first impressions I've had were really good. Like, it fits in my size hand really well. I can do so much. Yeah, the keyboard is not as narrow. I'm not sure if you've seen any of Samsung's previous foldables to sort of put a mental picture on the size of the device.
Mm-hmm. Got you. I'm actually looking at the picture on your website here, recharged.co.za. And I can see what you're talking about. It does fit perfectly in your hand. Maybe let's take a look at the specs of the Z Fold 8. When people purchase a phone, the first thing they want is the picture quality in terms of the camera. Maybe you can talk us through that. Battery life as well. And I see here the colors, cream, lavender, graphite, pistachio. Ooh, sounds delicious.
Yeah, it's great options on the device. Samsung always delivers a Snapdragon 8 Elite chipset made for Galaxy. So it's got the best chip. It's also alongside the Ultra version. So there's no compromise on performance. Both devices get the same chip. But what they have done with this device versus the Ultra, you get 250 megapixel cameras and not 200 megapixel on the Ultra, which is sort of understandable. So it's two lenses versus three and a slightly lower resolution. It does do dual video capture if you're vlogging or traveling and you want to get both perspectives, or even interviewing someone actually. And the battery life has improved compared to last year's Fold. It's 4,800 milliamp hours, which is quite sufficient, substantial. It's also the lightest Z Fold, so at 201 grams. I think that matters to some people. I mean, it easily fits in a bag. I've been using the Fold for most of last year. And as a journalist, I can tell you that I was conducting interviews, using it as a laptop replacement, doing all my work on the fly, publishing articles on my website, and I was using it on the treadmill. So I'm very excited to see how this new form factor will fare, especially because the screen has an anti-glare coating. So I can like use it as a Kindle. I actually downloaded the Kindle app on my test unit right now. And yeah, I can read outdoors if I want.
Interesting. So if you don't like something light and that fits in your hand, passport size literally, and you want to feel your device, want something a little bit heavier and a bit bigger, they've got the Z Fold 8 Ultra. Talk us through the specs of that one.
So the Ultra, like I mentioned, has a similar chipset as the 8, but it has a 200 megapixel camera and it's slightly heavier, 215 grams. I say heavy, but it's not that heavy. And the battery has also improved to 5,000 milliamp hour compared to last year's 4,400. I think that was one of the downsides to me on the Z Fold. So it feels like the Z Fold has graduated to Z Fold 8 Ultra, the Z Fold 7 rather, because it's a similar shape and size. It's thin. It has fast charging. But unlike the colors you mentioned earlier, the Fold Ultra comes in cream, graphite, and a dark violet and a darker green, which looks really nice. Mm-hmm. So sort of darker shades for the Ultra and pale shades for the regular Fold 8.
Talk us through the Z Flip 8 AI native. What's that about?
So they've now put a larger display, cover display on the device, and you can run all your AI tasks on the screen without having to open the phone. And if you want to get busy doing something else, or you lock the phone, you can actually see there's a little icon that shows you that the task is still running in the background, which is great because sometimes when you close your phone, it kills off whatever application you're running. So that's quite intuitive. It carries on doing what you needed to do without you having to keep the screen unlocked. Yeah, and it also means you're not opening the phone unnecessarily because you can do so much more on the cover display. And I really like how large it is now compared to, well, Gen 1, which is such a leap forward. But it also has 50 megapixel cameras. It's 180 grams, which is also lightweight. And yeah, also fun colors, cream, graphite, pink, and pistachio.
Ooh, pink. All righty. So let's take a look at availability and most importantly, price points.
So yes, as you know, because of the AI boom, the chips are now very expensive, which has an impact on smartphones and laptops, and this is the reason why the devices are coming in really expensive. The Z Fold 8 Ultra starts at 51,000 Rand. The Fold 8 regular passport size starts at 41,000 Rand. And the Flip 8 is 27,000 Rand. So quite pricey devices. But this is what we can expect going forward from all manufacturers because of this AI boom.
Yeah, I see here the Z Fold 8 Ultra, is it 1 terabyte? It's 60,999 Rand.
That's correct. If you want the larger capacity, the price I gave you for 51 was for the 512 gigs, which just as I mentioned, yeah, just for 512 gigs more, you're paying 10,000 Rand more. So maybe it's time to consider switching to cloud.
I tell you, even there's some costs, but anyway, it is what it is, isn't it? Thank you very much, Nafisa, for your time this evening. Nafisa Akapor with our digital drive feature. Thank you very much, Nafisa. And that's it from the SAFM Market Update team with MoneyWeb. My name is Duduzile Ramela. We're back with you again tomorrow evening. If you missed any of our stories, head on over to our website, www.moneyweb.co.za. Greg Ghos is standing by with the news. Have yourselves a magic evening. Bagaitshu, we like you.